Chapter 5 of A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Examination of the Content of Experience. Let us now fix our attention upon pure experience. In what does this consist when it comes into our consciousness, not elaborated by our thinking? It is merely juxtaposition in space and succession in time, an aggregate of nothing but unrelated single entities. No one of the objects which there come and go has anything to do with any other. At this stage, the facts of which we become aware and which mingle with our inner life are absolutely without bearing one upon another. There the world is a multiplicity of things of uniform importance. No thing, no occurrence, can lay claim to any greater function in the fabric of the world than any other constituent in the realm of experience. If it is to become clear to us that this or that fact possesses greater significance than another, we must not merely observe things, but arrange them in thought relationships. The rudimentary organ of an animal, which may not have the least significance in its organic functioning, possesses just as much value for our experience as the most important organ of the animal's body. That distinction between greater and lesser importance does not become apparent to us till we think back over the relationships of the individual constituents, that is, until we work over our experience. For our experience, the snail, which belongs to a lower stage in organization, is of equal value with the most highly evolved animal. The distinctions between degrees of perfection in organization become evident to us only when we lay hold conceptually upon the multiplicity given to us in experience and work it through. From this point of view, likewise, the culture of the Eskimo and that of the educated European are of equal value. Caesar's significance in the history of human evolution appears to mere experience no greater than that of one of his soldiers. In the history of literature, Goethe stands no higher than Gottsched, so long as we are considering mere experiential actualities. At this stage of observation, the world appears to our minds as an absolutely flat surface. No part of this surface rises above any other. None reveals to our minds any distinction as compared with others. Only when the spark of thinking strikes this surface do there come to light elevations and depressions. One thing appears more or less lifted above the other. All takes on a certain sort of form. Lines run out from one form to another. The whole becomes a self-sufficient harmony. The illustrations we have chosen seem to us to show with sufficient clearness what we mean in speaking of the greater or lesser significance of the objects of perception, parenthesis here considered as identical with the things of experience, parenthesis. What we mean by that knowledge which first comes into existence when we observe these objects in their interrelationship. These illustrations, we believe, insure us against the objection that the realm of our experience already reveals endless distinctions among its objects before thinking appears on the field. That a red surface, for instance, is different from a green surface even without any activity of thought. That is true. But anyone who would bring this argument to bear against us has entirely misconstrued our assertion. This is just what we maintain. That what is presented to us by experience is an endless mass of single entities. These single entities must naturally be different one from another. Otherwise they would not appear to us as an endless, unrelated multiplicity. We do not refer to an indistinguishableness among the things perceived, but to the absolute want of meaning in the single facts of the senses for the totality of our image of reality. It is just because we recognize this endless qualitative difference that we are driven to the conclusion indicated. If we were met by a unity well-defined, composed of harmoniously ordered constituents, we could not speak of the lack of distinction, insignificance among the constituents in relation to one another. Whoever, for such a reason, considers the comparison we have used inapplicable, must have failed to take hold of it at the real point of similarity. It would certainly be fallacious if we should compare the perceptual world with its endlessly varied forms to the uniform monotony of a surface. But our surface was not intended to resemble the manifold world of phenomena, but the unified total image that we have of this world, so long as thinking has not come in contact with it. After the action of thought, each single entity in this total image appears not as it was mediated by mere experience, but with the significance which it bears in relation to the whole of reality. At the same time, each appears with characteristics which were wholly wanting in its experiential form. According to our conviction, Johannes Volkelt has been remarkably successful in delineating within clear outlines that which we are justified in designating as pure experience. 5 years ago, 1881, this was strikingly described in his book on, quote, Kant's Erkenntnistheorie, and in his latest publication, Erfahrung und Denken, Experience and Thought. He has pursued the subject still further. He has done this, to be sure, in support of a point of view fundamentally different from ours, and a purpose unlike that of the present book. But this does not hinder us from setting down here his remarkable characterization of pure experience. This description simply shows us the images which pass before our consciousness in a brief period in a manner utterly void of interrelationships. Volkelt says, quote, "For example, my consciousness now has its content." "For example, my consciousness now has as its content the impression that I have worked diligently today. Immediately thereto is linked the impression that I can, with a clear conscience, take a walk. Again, there suddenly appears the perceptual image of the door opening and the postman entering. The image of the postman soon appears with outstretched hand, then with mouth opening, then doing the opposite. At the same time, there blend with the perceptual content of the opening mouth all sorts of impressions of hearing, among others that of rain beginning outside. The image of the postman vanishes from my consciousness, and the impressions which now enter have as their content, one by one, grasping the scissors, opening the letters, a critical feeling of illegible writing, visual images of the most varied written symbols, and, united with these, manifold imaginative images and thoughts. Scarcely is this series at an end when there reappears the impression of having worked diligently and, accompanied by depression, the consciousness of the continuing rain. Then both of these vanish from my consciousness, and there emerges an impression whose content is that a difficulty supposed to have been overcome in today's work has not been overcome. Accompanying this, there enter the impressions, freedom of will, empirical necessity, responsibility, the value of virtue, incomprehensibility, etc., and these unite with one another in the most varied and complicated ways, and so it continues." Unquote. Here is described for us, with regard to a certain limited space of time, what we really experience, that form of reality in which thinking has no participation. It need not be supposed that a different result would have been attained if instead of this everyday experience we had described what occurs in a piece of scientific research or in an unusual natural phenomenon. In these cases, as in that, what passes before consciousness consists of unrelated images. Thinking for the first time institutes interrelationship. We must also attribute to the pamphlet of Dr. Richard Wahler entitled Gehirn und Bewusstsein, Vienna, 1884, means brain and consciousness, the service of having indicated in clear contours that which is given to us by experience, void of any element of thought. Only we must make the reservation that what Vala describes as characteristics pertaining without restriction to the phenomena of the outer and the inner world holds good only for the first stage of our observation of the world, that stage which we have described. According to Vala, we know only a juxtaposition in space and succession in time. There can be, according to him, no talk of a relationship between the things appearing beside one another or after one another. For example, there may be somewhere and somehow an inner relationship between the warm sunbeam and the warming of the stone, but we know nothing of a causal relationship. To us, the only thing that is clear is that the second fact comes after the first. There may likewise be somewhere, in a world inaccessible to us, an inner relationship between our brain mechanism and our mental activity. But we know only that the two are occurrences running in parallel lines. We are not at all justified, for example, in assuming a causal relationship between the two. Of course, when Vala sets forth this assertion as the ultimate truth of science, we must oppose this extension of the assertion. But it is entirely correct as applied to the first form in which we become aware of reality. Not only are the things of the outer world and the processes of the inner void of interrelationship at this stage of our knowledge, but even our own personality is an isolated unit in comparison with the rest of the world. We perceive ourselves as one of the numberless percepts without relationship to the objects which surround us. Chapter 6. Correction of an Erroneous Conception of Experience as a Totality. This is the proper point at which to refer to a preconception persisting since the time of Kant, which has been so absorbed into the very life of certain circles as to pass for an axiom. Whoever should presume to question it would be considered a dilettante, a person not yet advanced beyond the most rudimentary concepts of modern philosophy. I refer to the opinion held as if it were established a priori that the whole perceptual world, this endless multiplicity of colors and forms, of tones and degrees of heat, were nothing more than our subjective world of representations, footnote, Vorstellungswelt, end footnote, possessing existence only so long as we keep our senses receptive to the influences from a world quite unknown to us. The whole phenomenal world is interpreted on the basis of this opinion as a representation, Vorstellung, inside our individual consciousness. And on the basis of this hypothesis are constructed further assertions regarding the nature of cognition. Folkelt also has adopted this opinion and bases upon it his theory of knowledge, a masterly production in its scientific process of development. Yet this is no basic truth, and least of all is it appropriate to form the very culmination of the science of knowledge. We would not be misunderstood. We have no desire to utter a protest, which would certainly be futile, against the contemporary achievements in physiology. But what is wholly justified as physiology is by no means, for that reason, appropriate to be set up before the very gateway leading to a theory of knowledge. It may pass as an unassailable physiological truth that the complex of sensations and percepts which we call experience first comes into existence through the cooperation of our organism. Yet it remains quite certain that such an item of knowledge as this can result only from much reflection and research. This characterization that our phenomenal world is, in a physiological sense, of a subjective character, is itself a characterization of that world reached by thinking, and has therefore nothing whatever to do with its first manifestation. It presupposes the application of thinking to experience. It must therefore be preceded by an inquiry as to the interrelationship between the two factors in the act of cognition. It is supposed that this opinion raises one above the pre-Kantian naivete, which considered the things in space and in time as constituting reality, as is still done by the naive person who has no scientific training. Volkelt makes the assertion, quote, all acts that call themselves objective cognitions are inseparably bound up with the individual cognizing consciousness. They take their course at first and immediately nowhere else than in the consciousness of the individual, and they are utterly incapable of reaching beyond the sphere of the individual and laying hold of the sphere of the real lying outside, or of entering it. End of quote. But it is quite impossible for unprejudiced thought to discover what that form of reality that touches us directly, experience, bears within itself that could in any way justify us in designating it as a mere representation. Even the simple reflection that the naive person observes in things nothing which could lead him to this opinion teaches us that no compelling reason for this assumption exists in things themselves. What does a tree, a table, bear within itself that could lead me to look upon it as a mere mental image? This should not then be asserted, least of all as a self-evident truth. Just because Volkelt does this, he entangles himself in a contradiction of his fundamental principles. According to our conviction, he could maintain the subjective nature of experience only by being disloyal to the truth recognized by him, that experience consists of nothing but an unrelated chaos of images without any thinkable definition. Otherwise, he would have been forced to see that the cognizing subject, the observer, is just as unrelated within the world of experience as is any other object belonging to it. But if one predicates subjectivity of the world of experience, this is at once a thought characterization, just as if one looks upon a falling stone as the cause of an impression made in the ground. Yet Volkelt himself will not admit any sort of interrelationships among the things of experience. Here lies the inconsistency in his conception. Here he becomes disloyal to the principle he has expressed regarding pure experience. Through this, he shuts himself up within his individuality and is no longer capable of emerging. Indeed, he admits this without reservation. Everything that lies beyond the disconnected images of perception remains for him in uncertainty. Our thinking, to be sure, endeavors, according to his view, to reach out from this world of mental images and infer an objective reality, but our going out beyond this world cannot lead to really known truths. All knowledge that we win by means of thinking is, according to Volkelt, not protected against doubt. It does not by any means attain to a certitude like that of immediate experience. This alone affords an indubitable knowledge. We have seen how defective is this knowledge. But all this grows out of the fact that Volkelt attributes to sense reality, experience, a characteristic which can by no means pertain thereto, and on this presupposition bases his further assumptions. It has been necessary to give special attention to this writing of Volkelt's because it is the most important contemporary work in this field, and also for the reason that it may serve as a typical specimen of all endeavors after a theory of knowledge which are in basic opposition to the direction of thinking that we present, founded upon Goethe's world conception. Chapter 7. Reference to the experience of the individual reader. We would avoid the fallacy of attributing a characteristic a priori to the immediately given, to the first form in which the outer and the inner world appear to us, and then establishing the validity of our reasoning on the basis of this presupposition. Indeed, by our very definition, experience is that in which thinking has no share. There cannot be any charge, therefore, of an error in thinking at the outset of our discussion. It is just here that the fundamental fallacy arises in many scientific endeavors, especially at the present time. Such scientists imagine that they are reproducing pure experience, whereas they are really reading again concepts which they themselves have interjected into the content of experience. It may be charged that we also have assigned a number of attributes to pure experience. We described it as endless multiplicity, as an aggregate of unrelated units, etc. Are not these also characterizations made by thought? Certainly not in the sense in which we have used them. We have made use of these concepts only to fix the reader's attention upon reality free from thought. We do not desire to attribute these concepts to experience. We employ them only to direct attention to that form of reality which is void of any concept whatever. All scientific inquiries must naturally be conducted by means of language, and language can express nothing except concepts. But there is an essential difference between employing certain words for the purpose of directly attributing this or that characteristic to a thing, on the one hand, and on the other employing these words merely to direct the reader's or the hearer's attention to an object. If we may resort to an analogy, we may say, these are two different things. When A says on the one hand to B, quote, "Observe that man in his family circle, and you will form an essentially different opinion of him from that which you form of him in his official behavior," unquote. And on the other hand, when he says, quote, "That man is an excellent father to his family," unquote. In the first instance, the attention of B is attracted in a certain manner. He is advised to form a judgment of a certain person under certain circumstances. In the second instance, a certain characteristic is attributed to this person, and therefore an assertion is made. As the first case here compares with the second, so does our initial step in the discussion compare with similar phenomena in literature. Since the exigencies of style or the difficulty of expressing our thought may at times give to the matter a different appearance, we wish to declare expressly at this point that our discussion is to be taken only in the sense here explained, and is far removed from any pretension of having advanced any assertion whatever which holds good of things in themselves. If now we are to have a name for the first form in which we observe reality, we are convinced that the name most adequately applicable is to be found in the expression, quote, "appearance to the senses," unquote. We here understand by the term sense not only the external senses, mediators of the external world, but all bodily and mental organs whatsoever which have to do with our becoming aware of the immediate facts. Indeed, the term inner sense is quite ordinarily used in psychology for the perceptive capacity as to inner experience. By the term appearance, however, we would designate merely a thing perceptible to us or a perceptible occurrence insofar as this appears in space or time. Here we must raise still another question, which will bring us to the second factor that we must observe in relation to the science of cognition, that is, thinking. Must we regard the form in which experience has hitherto been recognized by us as something rooted in the nature of things? Is it a characteristic of reality? Much depends upon the answer to this question. That is, if this form is an essential characteristic of the things of experience, something which belongs to them by their nature in the truest sense of the word, then it is impossible to see how this stage of knowledge can ever be surmounted. We should simply have to apply ourselves to the task of making unrelated notes of all that we experience, and such an assemblage of notes would constitute our science. For what could all research into the interrelationships of things accomplish if the complete isolatedness characterizing them in the form of experience represented their real nature? Let me read that sentence again. For what could all research into the interrelationships of things accomplish if the complete isolatedness characterizing them in the form of experience represented their real nature? The state of the case will be entirely different if in this form of reality we have to do not with its essential nature, but only with its quite unessential external aspect. If we have before us only a shell of the true nature of the world, which conceals that nature from us and requires us to search further for it, in that case, we should have to strive to break through this shell. We should have to proceed from this first form of the world in order to master its true characteristics, parenthesis, those essential to its being, parenthesis. We should have to surmount the, quote, appearance for the senses, unquote, in order to unfold out of this a higher form of appearance. The answer to this question is given in the following inquiries. Part C, Thought, Chapter 8, entitled Thinking as a Higher Experience Within Experience. Amid the unrelated chaos of experience, and indeed at first as a fact of experience, we find an element that leads us out beyond this unrelatedness. This element is thought. Thought, as one of the facts of experience, assumes an exceptional position within experience. As regards the rest of experience, so long as I limit myself to that which is immediately present to my senses, I do not advance beyond the separate units. Assume that I have before me a liquid which I bring to a boil. At first it is still. Then I observe bubbles rising. The liquid becomes agitated. Then all passes over into the form of steam. These are the percepts which follow one another. No matter how I may twist and turn the thing, if I am limited to that which the senses afford me, I discover no interrelationship among these facts. As regards thinking, such is not the case. If, for example, I grasp the thought of cause, this by its own content leads me to the thought of effect. I need only hold fast to the thoughts in that form in which they enter into immediate experience, and they appear as characterizations according to law. That which, as regards the rest of experience, must be brought from elsewhere, if indeed it is applicable at all, into relationship, according to law, is present as regards thought in its very first appearance. With respect to the rest of experience, that which enters as an appearance before my consciousness does not at once manifest the whole of reality. But with respect to thought, the whole thing passes over without residue into what is given to me. In the first case, I must penetrate the shell in order to reach the kernel. In the second, shell and kernel are an indivisible unity. It is only a universally human preconception if thought at first appears to us to be entirely analogous with the rest of experience. In the case of thought, we need only overcome this preconception within ourselves. In the case of the rest of experience, we need to resolve a difficulty inherent in the fact itself. That for which we seek, in the case of the rest of experience, has itself, in the case of thinking, become immediate experience. A difficulty is thereby resolved, which could scarcely be resolved in any other way. It is a justifiable demand of science that we should limit ourselves to experience, but it is a no less justifiable demand that we should seek for the inner law of experience. Therefore, this quote-unquote inner must itself appear at some place in experience. Experience is thus deepened by the help of experience itself. Our theory of knowledge makes the demand for experience in the very highest form. It repels every attempt to introduce something into experience from without. This theory finds even thought characterizations within experience. The form in which thought enters into manifestation is the same as that of the rest of the world of experience. The principle of experience is generally misunderstood both in its scope and in its true significance. In its baldest form, it is the demand that the objects of reality should be left in the form of their first appearance, and only thus treated as objects of knowledge. This is purely a principle of methodology. It says nothing regarding the content of what is experienced. If it should be asserted that only sense percepts can become the objects of knowledge, as is done by materialism, then it would not be possible to rest upon this principle. Whether the content be sensible or ideal is not decided by this principle. But if, in a certain case, it should be applied in the crassest form to which we are referring, it certainly makes a presupposition. That is, it demands that objects, as these are experienced, shall already possess a form sufficing the strivings of knowledge. As regards the experience of the external senses, as we have seen, this is not the case. It occurs only in the case of thought. Only in the case of thought can the principle of experience be applied in the most extreme sense. This does not exclude the principle from being extended also to the rest of the world. It possesses other forms besides the most extreme. If, for the purpose of scientific explanation, we cannot leave an object just as it is immediately experienced, yet this explanation can take place in such a way that the means which we employ for this purpose are taken from other spheres of experience. We have then not gone beyond the bounds of, quote, experience in general, unquote. A science of knowledge based upon Goethe's world conception lays its chief emphasis upon the principle of remaining always true to experience. No one has recognized so fully as Goethe the exclusive applicability of this principle. Indeed, he presented that principle just as rigidly as we have demanded above. All higher points of view concerning nature he would not look upon as anything except experience. They were considered as, quote, higher nature within nature, unquote. In the essay Nature, he says that we are incapable of getting outside nature. If, then, we desire to interpret nature to ourselves in this sense, which was his, we must find the means within nature herself. But how would it be possible to base a science of knowledge upon the principle of experience if we did not find anywhere in experience the basic element in all that is scientific, that is, ideal conformity to law? We need merely take hold of this element, as we have seen. We need merely submerge ourselves in it, for it exists in experience. Now, does thought really meet us and become known to our individuality in such a way that we can, with justice, claim for it the characteristics emphasized above? Anyone who fixes his attention upon this point will discover that an essential difference exists between the form in which an external phenomenon of sense reality becomes known to us, or indeed even some other process of our mental life, and that in which we become aware of our own thought. In the former case, we are definitely aware that we are in the presence of an already existent thing, existent, that is, insofar as it has become a phenomenon without our having exerted any determinative influence in its becoming. This is not true of thought. Only for the first moment does thought seem similar to the rest of experience. When we lay hold upon any thought, we know, in spite of the utter immediacy with which it enters our consciousness, that we are inwardly bound up with its manner of coming into existence. When any sudden idea occurs to me, entering my mind quite abruptly, so that its appearance is, therefore, from a certain point of view, very much like that of an external event, which must first be mediated to me by eye or ear, yet I always know that the field upon which this thought comes to manifestation is my own consciousness. I know that my own activity must first be called upon before the sudden idea can be made to come into existence. In the case of every external object, I am aware that at first it reveals only its outside to my senses. As regards a thought, I know quite certainly that what it exposes to me is its all, that it enters my consciousness as a totality, complete in itself. The external stimuli that we must always presuppose in the case of an external object are not present in the case of thought. It is to these stimuli that we must ascribe the fact that sensible phenomena appear to us as something already existent. It is to them that we must ascribe the genesis of these phenomena. As regards a thought, I have the assurance that this genesis is not possible apart from my own activity. I must work through the thought, must recreate its content, must live through it, even in its least details, if it is to have any significance for me whatever. Thus far, we have arrived at the following truths. At the first stage of world contemplation, the whole of reality meets us as an unrelated aggregate. Thought is included within this chaos. If we move through this multiplicity, we find in it one constituent which possesses, even in this first form of its appearance, that character which the rest of the multiplicity must afterward gain. This constituent is thought. That which must be surmounted in the case of the rest of experience, that is, the form of its immediate appearance, is to be retained in the case of thought. This factor of reality, which is to be allowed to remain in its original state, we find in our consciousness, and we are united with it in such fashion that the activity of our own mind is at the same time the manifestation of this factor. These are one and the same fact, seen from two sides. This fact is the thought content of the world. In the one instance, it appears as an activity of our consciousness. In the other, as the immediate manifestation of a conformity to law, complete within itself, a self-determined ideal content. We shall quickly see which side possesses the greater weight. Since, now, we stand inside the thought content, and permeate this in all its ingredients, we are in position really to know its very nature. The manner in which it meets us is a guarantee of the fact that the characteristics which we have attributed to it really belong to it. It can, therefore, certainly serve as the point of departure for every further form of world contemplation. The essential character of thought can be derived from thought itself. If we would arrive at the essential character of the rest of things, our point of departure in this inquiry must be thinking. Let us at once express the matter more clearly. Since we experience in thinking alone a real conformity to law and ideal determinateness, therefore the conformity to law of the rest of the world, which we do not experience in this itself, must also lie included within thought. In other words, thought and the appearance for the senses are face to face in experience. The latter, however, gives us no disclosure of its own nature. The former gives us this both as to itself and as to the nature of this appearance for the senses. Let me read that last sentence again. The latter, however, gives us no disclosure of its own nature. The former gives us this both as to itself and as to the nature of this appearance for the senses. It's the end of this section. It's chapters 5 through 8 of this book.